Hell hath no high goal fury. In honor of Unforgettable, what cinematic scorned ex do you feel bad for?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with both Bridget Moynihan and John Corbett in Serendipity, both because they seem pretty nice and didn't deserve to get dumped by Kate Beckinsale and John Cusack, but then they went on to be scorned exes again on Sex and the City. They really didn't deserve that twice.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I say Marion Ravenwood, who got spurned, got pregnant, got spurned again, and then had Shia LaBeouf. That's a lot.
I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Michael Showalter in the movie The Baxter, which is what that is. The Baxter is someone who keeps getting dumped. I feel bad for the guy.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I don't know if I necessarily feel bad for her, but I'm going to go with her anyway. Wayne Campbell's ex-girlfriend in Wayne's World, whatever her name is, because a gun rack. I don't even have a gun, let alone enough guns to necessitate needing to own a gun rack. Thank you.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 163. It's Tuesday, April 18th, and on this day in 1868, such a long time ago, the doc says San Francisco Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I'm assuming it was founded. Yeah, that's right.
It was founded.
Yeah.
So I just had to make sure I got the name correct because that was the fun fact for the day.
SPCA. Yeah, they didn't. Well, I guess it became the SPCA. Anyway, hooray for protecting animals. Before we get started, we have more reviews. We've been, diving into them. There's so many to choose from. David, what do you got?
Well, we're going to start down under today.
People love it when we do accents.
And they love us talking about Australia. We got a lot of responses to a question we can't remember about Australia, to be quite honest. But
now we're going to get some more. We're going to get some Australian movie industry experts on soon. Don't worry.
Yeah.
In breaking accent news, I have learned that I can do David Lynch in Twin Peaks, but cannot do Vin Diesel in anything, except for maybe The Iron Giant, but definitely not any of the Fast and Furious movies.
Where are you performing these voices?
For my future wife.
Oh. Can you imagine? Yes, she stays.
Can you imagine such agony?
Such well, can you say, like, Ride or Die as David Lynch? Can I make a request?
Cool. No, I can't. I can't do it on command. Please.
Sorry.
Now, Patches, who is this review from Australia from? I don't know if...
I'm going to look it up as you read it. Because okay. People have wisely sent in their international reviews via our Facebook page because we are really, really bad at checking international iTunes pages. It's really difficult. It's not an easy thing. This is from, I don't know if she wants Amy. I'll say Amy because, you know, Facebook tells you their whole name, and that's not fair. Amy. Amy from Australia.
Amy. Amy from Australia. Love this podcast. Coop. Ever so much. Feel sad that so many reviewers suggest more Joanna. When, as wonderful as she is in so many podcasts that I worry for her larynx. And frankly, having Gen Pop, Storm of Spoilers, and Little Gold Men did each week, I am happy to just hang with the core Fitwork crew. Stay just the way you are. You have great dynamics and are pleasantly down to earth. Not that I object to guests. By all means, have guests. I am from Australia and get films much later, so it's nice to listen to your reviews and be way ahead of friends when deciding what to actually see. I find ways to keep up with television, but the Australian cultural media can't help me with analyzing it, so I'm glad to have you all. Being from Australia, I feel I need to correct your opinions recently expressed about kangaroos. Now, side note, me speaking, I have no idea what she's talking about. Was this an episode that I missed where you all... insulted kangaroos or something?
Oh, yeah.
I talked about my brother shooting some kangaroos when he was in Australia.
That is terrible. Is your brother like the Don Trump Jr. of your family?
No, he was on a farm and apparently they were
in
the way
for his life story.
No,
whatever.
All right, yeah.
All right, we don't hate them. We love kangaroos, but we worry about hitting them in our cars if we drive out of town. And we have caused a population explosion by clearing land, and there are now three times as many gray kangaroos as the British invaded 230 years ago. And actually, these days, hippies and environmentalists like to eat kangaroo meat because they have a happier life experience before they die, unlike your sad-assed American cows and hoofed animals wreck out soil and cause erosion and need too much water. So basically, we live them and shoot them like gorgeous, furry, bouncy femme fatales.
Wow.
Wow.
I feel like this Amy and I have a lot in common, and one of the things that we have in common is that is
eating kangaroo.
Ambien and then write on the internet, because this review definitely sort of the butter slid off the knife as it went along, but I enjoyed it very much.
I still feel like kangaroos sound like Australian deer. Maybe we should all be eating more deer.
They do. They're running in front of cars, that is absolutely the Australian
hopping
deer. I'm going to read two very quick reviews from America, and then we'll start the show. Sarah's My Name, Films My Game says, a simply magical podcast. You've probably already discussed the very important subject of which Hogwarts house you would all be in. I'm sure that we have. But I'm too lazy to find out. another reader after my own heart talking about how lazy she is. Therefore, allow me to sort you myself, thus providing the ultimate verdict. Oh, wow, this review's longer than I thought. I apologize to our readers. Listeners, on the matter, let's start with the easy one. David is a clear Slytherin. Ugh. He's proud and ambitious, occasionally sly. He often takes on an antagonistic role, presenting a contrary opinion to that of the group. This by no means is a knock against David. His recent touching review of The Excellent Personal Shopper has only confirmed him as my favorite of the four. Redeemed.
Hey.
Next is Katie, Fitwer's resident Gryffindor. Katie is the true leader of the group, the glue that binds it all together, the voice that moves the conversation forward. She's perhaps the easiest to identify with of the four, thus making her the protagonist. And protagonists are inevitably Gryffindors. On to Patches. Patches is obviously a Hufflepuff, obviously. He defends the movies he loves with most admirable loyalty and dedication. He's also very likable, if in a somewhat goofy way. And with a name like Matt Patches, Hufflepuff is really the only option. Finally, Dave Seven. I struggled with Dave's placement the most, but I now feel confident with him putting him in Ravenclaw. We all have to be in different houses? Joe, I just really like if this worked out with all of you in different houses. Dave Seven quietly does a lot of the behind-the-scenes work, demonstrating his attention to detail and really great taste in music. He's the voice that sometimes gets lost in the shuffle, but one that's consistently thoughtful and intelligent. And in true Ravenclaw form, he knows more than anyone when it comes to in-depth lore of various universes and franchises. Oh, and by the way, Joanna and Jordan are the occasional exchange students from international schools. Joanna hails from
Of course she does.
Because she's the one that people collectively lose their minds over. And Jordan is from Durmstrang because people seem to either dislike him or are apathetic towards him. Anyway, 5 stars. Was this review helpful? Absolutely. And finally, real quick, Trump's deregulation has allowed me to finally write a review by Wooden Lens. My deep sleep this morning had a sudden rude awakening. I had a nightmare that the four wonderful voices forever hiding in my earbuds since the early
days. I feel like we read this
suddenly,
one last week.
I do, yeah.
We did?
Yeah, in your absence.
I never listened to this podcast.
Lame.
I'm going to say, was it helpful? Sure. I mean, it was helpful that Dave remembered that we listened to it, so it was certainly memorable. Okay, that's it for this week.
I think this is the part where we have to encourage people to actually leave reviews because it's fun.
Oh,
It is fun. I mean, look at how much fun we're having with these reviews. The more fun they get,
I learned a lot about kangaroos.
Do you feel like you're a Hufflepuff?
I don't think that's what I got in my Pottermore selection process, but I'll have to look at my files. I'll have to go back to my owls and see what I got.
You don't just know? I don't know. God, you're lame.
I know.
I don't know it in my heart, you mean?
Or just like in your heart, or just like off the top of your head. I feel like it's your house, man.
I mean, I guess. I'm kind of wacky. I just think putting Raven kids in houses is cruel and unusual behavior. No one should be in one house. What is wrong with people? You should be able to go take classes in Gryffindor, take classes with Hufflepuff. They should mix and mingle. What is wrong? They're creating a class
together.
System within a high school.
Socialist.
It's insane.
They take classes
Socialist.
Together, you maniac.
Ugh. Don't pit schools. Don't pit classes against each other. They shouldn't be competing points and such.
Are you Bernie Sanders now?
Listen to me. Bring the kids together.
And billionaires.
We gotta break up the houses in Hogwarts. Anyway, that's what he says on his podcast, I'm sure, when you leave him reviews.
Okay. talking about Fate of the Furious until David was back, because we wanted David to join us to talk about family, because we are family.
We're family.
I haven't seen Fate of the Furious because I have a family that includes an infant. So guys, tell me what I missed.
You aren't the only one who has a family that includes an infant, Katie.
Oh, that's true. I did get spoiled on how the movie ends. So,
oh wait, is this going to be a spoiler section? We should have raised a flag here.
I don't know. Okay, it's a Fate of the Fury. It's the eighth movie.
It made like $300 million this weekend.
Wait, so the first of all, movie if you in know, a franchise if, is exempt. So when we all go see Star Wars, we can just we can say what happened.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. This is going to be a spoiler-filled conversation about Fate of the Furious. Go, baby Brian.
I don't know.
I just did it.
Dom has a baby.
Baby Brian.
With the blonde what's-her-face who got replaced when Michelle Rodriguez's Letty came back.
When Michelle Rodriguez agreed to a new contract, is what you mean? Oh.
Okay, wait.
Yeah, damn. So basically, she could have been our answer for like the most like horribly scorned ex, because she's back and selflessly held captive along with her baby, so that Cypher, played by Charlize Theron, can use Dom against his team to get nuclear codes for a nuclear submarine. And she does this what? To Dom, supposedly.
That's not the only thing
movies...
she wanted, was it? She also wanted the God's Eye. She wanted a lot of things. It was a little confusing. She just wanted the submarine?
Well,
She
had to get the God's Eye to track the Russian ambassador who had the football.
Let's just say so she made she a lot of finger movements and sneering. So
the arch franchise thing is that she was behind the evil team from the past two movies, and maybe more, and is now the big bad of the Fast and Furious franchise, as far as we know.
The Blofeld.
So she's the. She's the Blofeld hacker that's been secretly controlling Charlize Theron.
Blame. Wait, can I ask?
And she jumped out of a plane, so she'll definitely be back, but probably as a good guy.
Yes.
Well, you know, as per Fast and Furious tradition, yeah, exactly. Exactly what Pat just said. She will inevitably be brought into their team the next time, and even though
when Thanos comes to Earth.
Yeah, like no one will give a shit. The same way that this movie has no respect for Han or his legacy. It doesn't matter that. What the fuck is it? Oh, Deckard Shaw killed him. Whatever.
Yeah, how did they turn Jason Statham into a good guy?
Of the franchise.
There's a retcon, David. Ooh. They're gonna bring Han back, and he won't be dead. It would have been a fake death. Don't you see?
What about Giselle?
Giselle's dead.
But my question.
She's Wonder Woman. It's fine.
Is that has there ever been a movie couple with less chemistry than Michelle Rodriguez and Vin Diesel?
There's a scene where they lay in bed in this one that looked awkward. It was very, like, maybe because they were positioning her to be sexy and it was supposed to be, like, a romantic novel cover or something, but it was very awkward.
I think at this point it's, like, Stockholm Syndrome with that couple in this franchise.
They've been through a lot, David. Dave,
is this like, and we've been through a lot with them, so at this point I'm like, yeah, that's the couple.
That's what romance looks like.
Yeah, unless you the actor who plays you literally dies, you do not escape your place in the Fast and Furious.
I think the problem is that Michelle Rodriguez is not; she doesn't have the same acting style as Vin Diesel. She's very expressive, and I think as a solo performer, I want to watch her. Well, actually, she's quite good in the Resident Evil movies, where she can just be crazy and run around and gun people down. But Vin Diesel's this stoic grunter, and she's just so expressive, and yeah, they don't match. There's a problem there, and she stands out in this movie because most people are on Vin Diesel's wavelength. She's probably the worst actor in this movie. I take that back. Scott Eastwood is horrible.
Scott Eastwood,
the replacement for oh my god, I'm blanking.
Paul Walker?
But not replacement. Kurt Russell is also... Oh, the replacement for Paul Walker.
Yes, the spiritual
replacement. I mean, not really. Yeah, he doesn't, like, take the place. This movie's horribly paced in terms of what the little story it's trying to tell and what it thinks is important. And, like, there's a few Fast and the Furious moments where I'm like, this problem could be solved by braking. There's several times in this movie where I'm like... What do these people think the nuclear football is? Like, why don't you just, like, give up your life so that there isn't, like, nuclear war? Like, fuck your son. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, I get that because it's at this point, a Tomorrow Never Dies level of ridiculousness. Dom's has this confidence that he's going to be able to like pull it off at the end. But in like the world of reality where like you're going to like give a nuclear sub to like a super evil hacker person, it's like you think more people would take bullets instead, be like, no, I'm not going to harm my family. Fuck the family. Why do you need to take an orange Lamborghini? The future of the world is at stake.
But here's
I can't
the thing.
Believe that you came out of Fast and Furious and said, fuck your family, which is the entire opposite of the message of the franchise.
But that is the underlying inadvertent theme of Fate of the Furious, which is that family, which has been the glue of this franchise for so long, they've decided it no longer really matters. Enemies can become friends with no explanation. Whatever's going to sell tickets, whatever's going to be cute. This movie completely betrays everything the Fast and Furious is.
What's shocking, you're so on point, that family is over for this franchise because family is intrinsically tied to the script and dialogue and character, and these elements are officially done. I was really shocked to see, and maybe the other Fast movies have done this too, and I was just off my radar, but Fate of the Furious made $190 million in China. This weekend. And that is just astronomical. Like, so this is officially a superhero movie. I mean, they were kind of always going that way, but this is truly must be translated in all languages, must be bombastic in every possible beat. Like, the script elements of this movie are a thing of the past. Chris Morgan, this longtime screenwriter, is now the architect, like in The Matrix. And it's just beyond that. It's beyond family. It's going to be just get these people. They're going to be racing on the Great Wall of China in the next installment. And in Fast 10, they're going to be in space. They're definitely going to be in space. But
why
can't they
also be about family and be in space?
Because you can't stop and talk anymore. I mean, it's like there's no time. Get in the car and do something crazy.
No. That's the problem. There is so much time to stop and talk about what they're doing, or to joke about what cars they can or can't use, or to joke about who like knows things or who doesn't know things. So much goddamn time. Maybe. We spend an easy 5 minutes watching The Rock's daughter's soccer game, and not even watching the soccer game, but like watching the soccer game and trying to ignore this government guy who's trying to give him like this bullshit. So much. There's like a 10-minute sequence at the beginning of the movie that comes up again once in like a series of flashes to explain who the fuck these people are in this like now you see me reversal. It's just so, after like seeing Justin Lin, I've been rewatching Fast and Furious movies so we could do a Storm of Spoilers thing on the whole franchise, and so I like rewatched 6 like 2 days ago, and that's like deliciously stupid. 5's deliciously stupid. 7 is at least like enjoyable.
7 is my favorite. 7 is not stupid. 7 has the right balance of family.
No. 7 knows it's stupid.
Family and action. I thought 7 was a home run.
Yes. No, it has family and action, but it also the thing it does is it does an outrageous sequence and then Jason Statham shows up and makes like things like upset. So it's like it's an interesting formula to have like multiple teases like that. I think, you know, 5 and 6 are still going to be my favorite of the action part of the franchise, but it's so weird to see this movie after it started with like this very serious FBI embedded street racing
franchise.
It's
so funny to go back to the first one now when they're like stealing DVDs.
Hey, DVD TV combos, okay? Yeah. Those are precious items.
And now they're like an elite.
The NOS isn't going to pay for itself, buddy.
Elite Mission Impossible spy team. There's a one point where, like, in this movie, someone casually puts on, like, rocket wings.
And you're like, what? Well, what's weird is Tyrese at some point goes, like, why are we here? What are we doing? And it's like, no, why are you here? What are you doing? Why are you guys the best people to pull off this mission? Why would you drive a Lamborghini onto the ice in Russia? There's no point to any of that. But like,
I remember in Fast Five when they walked away with a ton of money, and it was like, all right, no one needs to come back.
Yeah, right. You're all forgiven. But wait, so to wrap this up, I mean, I think we're not being that snarky. This movie is not that good, and it didn't have too much to live up to. I feel like if the action were good, it'd be better. If the characters were a little funnier or the script was a little tighter, it would be a better movie. But, like, what does it mean for a Fast movie to be good?
This is, I mean, I think that...
What does it have really to accomplish?
I think they really whiffed here. I mean, they had a pretty much a gimme, which is you get an ungodly amount of money to make any kind of action movie you want with characters that people already love. And the dynamics are already in place, and you really just need to tap into the same thing you've done for so long. And what they did was come up with, like, a shitty Die Hard sequel. Not, like, a sequel to the movie Die Hard, but, like, one of the shitty Die Hard sequels. Like, a Len Wiseman film with some generic awful hacker named Cypher who stands in a room and says it's zombie time as awful CG cars, like, pour around the streets of Cleveland. Which is plenty.
There aren't that many self-driving cars in New York City, are there?
No.
That freaked me out.
And
well, also, the it's like the one thing that the entire computer graphics industry knows how to do on a budget is make convincing cars. It's so weird that this movie doesn't have convincing CGI cars all the time.
I just thought that, like, this was... And F. Gary Gray has made good car chase movies before. I mean, like, Italian Job is pound for pound.
It's a much better
significantly
movie.
Significantly better. And it's like, what the fuck happened? Oy, oy.
Well, using the CG car models from the Cars movies was probably a bad idea.
I did like the eyeballs.
But we do know where they're looking now.
I'm glad Mater had a cameo. This past weekend, one of my favorite shows came back on HBO, Veep, the political satire starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus? Yeah, that's right. Julia Louis-Dreyfus? I think, yeah.
and the Catalan accent.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus? No, that's a little French. Anyway, the show came back, and frankly, I was a little worried about how it was going to come back because of how the season 5 ended last summer. Everything that has happened in the political world since that could not be possibly spoofed. And then trying to pick it back up. So, Katie, you just rewatched season 5. Fill us in what happened right before the end of the season. And then we'll talk very quickly about what happened on season 6.
To be clear, I watched the season 5 finale. I had watched the season on and off.
Well, no,
I wasn't
what happened in the finale?
Anyway, so because of arcane rules that I couldn't totally follow, a vote in the House leads to Laura Montez, who is a white woman who married a Hispanic man and now calls herself Laura, which is funny, became the president. And Selina Meyer, Julia Louis-Dreyfus' character, thought she had these backroom deals that she would become vice president again, which seemed kind of like a funny way for the show to go. And now she is out of office entirely. And, I mean, the finale ended with her just, like, forlornly sitting with the Washington Monument in the background, which is kind of a nice shot. And then it opens, and she is moved into offices in the Bronx, I think, where she has her foundation, shades of Bill Clinton. She's in Harlem, which is exactly where the Clinton Foundation offices were.
Yeah.
And then you see kind of all of her staff kind of spread to the winds and figuring out what they're going to do.
It's 1 year later, I believe. Everyone's trying to stay in the political world. Dan is working for, like, CBS News, and Jonah is... He's a congressman who's pretending to have cancer, and Mike, played by Matt Walsh, is raising
have
his family.
And now he's just
he had 6 weeks of chemo, and now he's shaving his head.
Last night was the first episode of Veep that I've seen all the way through, so I'm very caught up.
Oh, good.
But I've seen bits and pieces of so many episodes, and I feel, you know, in response to Patches and Katie's concern that the show may not have anywhere to go from last season. Is there also a sense that, like, as long as there is a Washington, D.C. and HBO is not censored, the show can always go on? There will always be more insults that people can hurl at each other.
Well, what's interesting is that it seems like it takes place – it feels like a utopian version of Washington at the moment, where it's just this alternate world where none of this – what we're living has really happened. And yet it's taking place in its own universe, so it totally works and plays. And as you said, as long as they're slinging mud, it kind of works. But
And Veep gives you such a good frame for when you hear stories about, like, Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner fighting with each other over really petty stuff. Like, if you've watched Veep, you can really imagine exactly how that happens. And people have always said that Washington is more of Veep than House of Cards, and now it's not hard to believe that. Yeah. Like, you know exactly what these idiots are talking about.
And that said, it's still reckoning a little bit. I mean, I don't know how much was written before the election. I assume a lot to get to this, you know, release point, but it feels like it's reckoning with everything that's happened politically. Selena Meyer wants to run for president again, and her one aide or her one former aide kind of tells her, like, don't. You know, no one wants a Selena Meyer comeback. And she starts almost weeping, and it's a poignant moment, and I couldn't help but think of everything that Hillary is going through right now for some reason, just like people still breaking her apart and dissecting the election and talking about what she'll do in the future. I don't know. That really struck me between the laughs.
Yeah, there's going to be some interesting parallels there. I even watching the season 5 finale, which aired last June, I was noticing how Selena is wearing this very purple coat at inauguration, the inauguration of her successor, the woman who beat her. And Hillary Clinton, in her concession speech the next day, famously wore purple, which was kind of interpreted for its symbolism. And that's something that they had no way of seeing coming. But there's going to be weird echoes like that throughout, I think. But the fact that she's not in the office anymore and it's not going to be set in the White House, I think, is a huge blessing for this show.
Yeah, distance yourself from reality just a little bit.
Yeah, well, and like have new territory to mine. It's been on for a long time. You kind of need to change things up.
Yeah, we have the Sean Spicer show already. We don't need another show.
I wonder how Matt Walsh feels. I mean, Matt Walsh played the press secretary on Veep. How he just feels looking at Sean Spicer.
I think I read a piece today that said he thinks that his character from Veep, honestly, it would be a better press secretary.
Probably.
Which pretty much
is,
anyone.
You know, it's hard to argue with.
All
yeah,
right, before
a
we,
joke where someone said something like Holocaust centers would have felt too absurd, maybe.
Well, Veep goes some dark territory already in this first episode, so we'll keep track of it. Keep watching Veep. 10 episodes started last Sunday. HBO, do it. Probably over to y'all, probably be locked by the force, trying to hustle some bands, that go with the Porsche, feeling no remorse, feeling like my hand was forced, middle finger to the law, nigga, gripping my balls, said the ladies, they love me, from the bleachers, they screaming, all the ballers is bouncing, they like. Let's talk about something that David wrote. How about that? That doesn't have anything to do with Harry Potter, so David can understand what we're talking about. David!
I understand.
Netflix provides me with my TV shows, and it lets me watch episodes of 30 Rock whenever I want, and then every now and then it releases a really good movie that I wouldn't be able to see in theater otherwise because I can't leave my house. What do you got against it?
So why are they ruining cinema from the inside, shitting all over one of our most precious institutions? Yeah, I wrote an article today. It was on IndieWire. I did not necessarily foresee the fur that it would cause. I'm not usually a furster.
Furster?
Is that a rural furster? Jerk? Because I referenced 30 Rock.
What is fur?
Rural jerk.
Fur?
But
Fuhrer.
Fur, like a fur, not a Fuhrer.
But you were saying fur, like first. I didn't
like Mad Max.
Is that like when Jimmy Fallon takes Trump's hair and does like a stir?
They are encouraging us at work where I work to write more sort of reactive essays and whatnot about what's happening in the world, and so maybe I'll be stirring
a hot
up some
take
dander
or
more
two.
I don't know. Yeah, but this was something that I was genuinely agitated about and have been for some time, which is that Netflix is destroying the idea of movies being movies as we know them, movie theaters. And I'm not and so I went on a little bit of a rant about how Netflix is buying up all these great movies, including movies that are going to be premiering at Cannes, such as the new Noah Baumbach film, the new Bong Joon-ho film, and so on. And the new Bong Joon-ho film starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Tilda Swinton is not necessarily, I mean, Snowpiercer was mishandled, but it's not necessarily like a tiny art house movie. I mean, this could do well. They had rights to the film that won Sundance this year, I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, by Macon Blair, which is very, very good. They are getting better and better movies, and they are not giving theatrical releases to any of them, and I don't buy for a second this deal with iPick, which is I think I described it in the piece as Alamo Drafthouse for wealthy people who hate movies. And that is exactly what iPick is, and they have very few screens, and they really only have that deal in place so that they can be eligible for awards if and when they have a movie that they want to push in that way. So really they're making it so that it's impossible to see these movies on the big screen as they were originally intended, unless you go to the festivals, and it's a shame. And my piece is sort of arguing, and I love Netflix in a lot of respects. I watched every single episode of 30 Rock now, save for the last season, which we're currently working our way on. I love that I can download things now. I can rewatch episodes of Mad Men on the subway.
The way they were meant to be seen, obviously.
Well, I've already seen the show on TV as it aired, and then all the way through on Blu-ray, and now I feel like I'm just going. I think that Netflix, and yeah, I think that in getting people access to movies that they wouldn't have otherwise, I think Netflix potentially a great service. But what I was arguing was that Netflix, which certainly has the money and the wherewithal, if they were only patient, and if they had any interest in cinema as an art form and preserving the experience, which of course they don't, they would have some sort of theatrical release. I think a lot of people misconstrued what I wrote to say that some sort of elitist attitude where only the coastal elite should have access to these films. What I was saying was quite the opposite. I think that they're not mutually exclusive. I think that not only – Netflix is burying these movies is another one of my complaints, and that a theatrical release, as Amazon has done it so well, especially with Manchester by the Sea, can call attention to the eventual streaming release. All of these movies are going to wind up on streaming eventually anyway, and many, many of the other companies that would otherwise be putting out these films have – Netflix built into the back end. So you're really, we're talking about a small matter of time before they get to Netflix. And I would hope that Netflix a proper and just world could be aggressive enough to put it in theaters where you don't necessarily need to live in New York. But Netflix obviously has no interest in,
they
don't want people to do
this. This is not necessarily true, at least if you read their shareholder message that they issued this week about quarter one. Just to address a few of the things that you mentioned, they say in their piece to shareholders that they would be open to AMC and Regal picking up their movies if they want those films, but actually the theaters choose not to host them because they don't want to put movies in theaters that are also available on Netflix. So this is a choice. Netflix wants to be able to put them on the platform for people who want them, but they can easily put them in theaters too if people would agree to that, and
it's
they choose not to. So the difference is Amazon.
Kind of a choice.
Right. Well, Amazon creates deals that gets them into theaters first, and then they go to Amazon. But so Netflix is forcing their hand and forcing them to change the industry, and they're choosing not to. So it's a little more complicated than Netflix saying these will not be in theaters.
I don't necessarily believe that.
What do you not believe?
I think that theaters ultimately have as little choice in the matter as filmmakers do, which is why this whole article was sort of sparked by, in addition to the film board in France saying that a film premiering on Netflix would essentially challenge its nature as a cinematographic art.
But why?
Whatever highfalutin language they used. Because in France, a film has to wait 36 months after its theatrical debut before it premieres.
I mean, but the things you're saying,
I was saying in the piece that it was inspired by this guy, this article in the New York Times about Tramps, which is a very cute movie directed by this guy named Adam Leon, and his relief when Netflix swooped in with their incredibly over-aggressive offer to make everybody whole, and how...
Everybody whole mean? Just explain that.
Just to make sure that all the people who supported this filmmaker and invested their money in his work, it was a guarantee overnight that he was going to be able to pay all of them back, plus profit. And also, he's not going to have to deal with any of the international rights. I mean, Netflix deals with it worldwide. It's done. You don't have to negotiate every territory separately. You don't have to...
They got the money.
There's so many opportunities there to get screwed. You got the money. They got the money. And that is, I think, when you've been neck deep in something for longer than a year, 2 years, however long it's been at this point, that is, it's really hard to blame an independent filmmaker with for accepting that deal. And Adam Leon doesn't really have his choice. I mean, like, the producers, the investors, those are the people that get the yay or nay vote in most of these cases.
Let me jump in here.
At the same time, you have someone like James Gray.
Let me address your...
Let me finish this thought. Okay. It was a much higher profile filmmaker and is working with much bigger budgets and film and stars like Robert Pattinson and filming 35 million...
And Annapurna, like, who's determined to put... movies
and Annapurna and James Gray it can't pay his bills. So, you know, there is no middle anymore. The middle class is falling away. The middle of the movie's falling away. And so additionally, it's hard to blame it, but Netflix just exploits these things at every turn to essentially...
The demonizing is... I mean, look, I take Netflix to task a lot. We had somebody comment on fightingintheworm.com about how apparently I'm haranguing Netflix constantly for having a bad... library of movies that's really fallen away since they started streaming in 2007, which is true, but I won't harangue that point. But I feel like I have to step up and defend Netflix a little bit here, because I think your piece has two distinct complaints that are easy to group together, but maybe shouldn't necessarily be. One is that movies deserve a chance to be in theaters. That's probably true. I'd love to see Netflix movies play on the big screen in any city in any stretch of time, just to see them on the big screen. That's cool. Like, I was happy to see The Discovery. We talked about this a little on the podcast. See Charlie McDowell's movie at Sundance on the big screen. That was a luxury. But it also felt that way, too. Like, Netflix had a hand in that, so they were going to bring it to the Netflix platform. It's their right. They helped make that movie, and it's technically their business. I mean, Netflix is a tech company. I don't really see them as a distributor, and they're trying to disrupt the way we watch and provide... To use the terms they would. To use the terms they would. And that they see... They're a digital media company that sees... movies as video content to put out there by any means necessary. And if you talk to Silicon Valley people, they want to democratize things. They want to have everyone have the ability to see this. And I know that you're saying, David, I mean, I generally don't think that you are flexing too much privilege here when you make this argument that these movies deserve a chance in theaters and they shouldn't go straight to Netflix, but it's implicit too. Like, we do have a luxury here in New York and in L.A. and in big cities, but not everyone has that art theater around the corner. And you say that they bury movies. It's true that the algorithm, you know, puts certain things in front of you or may never allow you to see certain things. But I also see movies that I've never heard of, especially like foreign movies and television shows that I didn't even know were on the platform one day. And it's all of a sudden in front of me because it's the things I like. So, David, the audience that you want to see these movies will, because they like these movies. And this is actually making your job as a critic more important than ever, because you can tell them when it's on Netflix and they can see it right then and there, as opposed to you talking about movies, you know, 8 weeks in advance, these small movies you saw at a festival that no one's going to see. Suddenly you can talk about them one day, and 2 weeks later, as in the case of I Don't Feel at Home in the World Anymore, they can be on Netflix, and that person who's heard about it on this podcast can go see that movie. They don't need it to be on their homepage. They're driven to go see it. And I just want to be transparent here for 1 second. What was the biggest story on Thrillist.com in February? It was our review of I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, because it was crazy.
Really?
And we had a great... I mean, we just loved the movie, and we put it on Facebook, and it was there for people to watch, and people went nuts for it. And it's because of Netflix.
Half right. I think that that Netflix certainly doesn't diminish the job of the film critic. I think that we play a new and different role that sort of augments the one we already do, and I recognize that. I also think that we have it within our power. This is one of the things that the internet grants us, unlike print media, to put a film on people's radar the day it premieres, let's say, and then sort of keep up with that story, remind people that it exists, and so on. However, I was a little blindsided by the whole privilege element of it, because the root of my argument is that people everywhere or anywhere should be able to see these movies as they were intended. They should be able to see them as movies. And worst comes to worst, if there's really no theater near where you are, and I'm living... I mean, this article was sort of written from an idealistic perspective where, in theory, if Netflix wanted to make the world a better place, they'd be able to put these movies in small art houses across the world. Then it's I'm not saying you never get to see the movie. I'm just saying it's like
I know, but now you actually get to have a conversation with people about it when it's out. You don't have to exhaust.
You know what? But that's counter to Netflix's whole idea. Stranger Things is on Netflix, and the fucking promotion cycle lasts a year. It doesn't need to be in one day. That's the opposite of what Netflix means. We're not
these movies don't need promotion cycles. They need conversations spurred by the people who love them and find them.
So why doesn't Netflix give an iota of the attention that it gives to any of its independent
for the same reason these movies wouldn't have an iota of promotion if they were playing in movie theaters? It's not worth it. What's the point? You're not going to spin a brand out. Look, all the kids from Tramps aren't going to be on Fallon tomorrow. Like, get real.
So why is Netflix buying these movies for several million dollars if they don't deem that it's worth it to promote them? If they're just going to bury them under old episodes of Fuller House.
How are they burying them when they're available for people to find? You don't need to promote them. People will find them. The people who want to see them will find them. They don't need to be promoted.
I don't think that's true, and two, unfortunately, and this is
what is your purpose if not to tell people to see these movies on Netflix?
We will never know if anyone's seen these movies. The filmmakers don't even know if anyone's seen these movies because Netflix is less transparent than the fucking Trump administration.
Except here's the thing. They do know that people see them because we have social media. And again, Netflix knows that technology enables this for people. The conversation is occurring. Filmmakers don't need to know the numbers. Of course, they need to feel the warmth of people receiving the movie.
I want to make an argument.
That is an insane thing to say. Go to your film investor and say, no, I got some warmth from the last movie. Please give me several million dollars. I'd like to see how that works out for you.
All right. I feel like both of you have points. I'm trying to figure out where I want to jump in on this. One thing about Netflix not releasing them in theaters is it's not eligible for awards. So unlike Stranger Things, which is going to be competing at the Emmys or God knows what other thing.
The IPIC deal allows it to be.
Oh, so they will be actually making them eligible?
That's the only reason they have this deal. And Ted Sarandos says, oh, it's because we don't want people to see them as TV movies. It's bullshit. They only want to have this deal in place
Award season is full of nonsense excuses about why they're doing whatever. The transparency thing on Netflix, I do think that's a problem. It's going to be an ongoing problem in Hollywood. And the thing that it doesn't have that something like iTunes does is something like a most downloaded chart or like some kind of landing page where you can see the independent films. Just the sheer organization of Netflix. I think that David saying the movie it's been buried is not quite accurate because it's kind of up to people like us to figure out how to write about them and not just the way that we write about TV shows. It's kind of a whole new method
Film. Personally, when I write about movies and I'm saying Netflix, it doesn't matter what size movie it is anymore. That's why I was shocked people click and engage with this I don't feel at home in the world anymore review.
No, I mean, it's I think like, you have the audience that's going to pay attention to it, but it's not getting the same attention as like the next season of Orange is the New Black. But I think that's a level of media catching up.
Right. Well, I mean, a television show has recurring and can build momentum. A movie doesn't have that, but the movie will always exist and will be on, you know, if people are doing roundups or whatever. But here's the thing. By not having box office or by not having stats on how many people watched it, you don't create a competitiveness in the audience. Like Hollywood created a terrible atmosphere where fanboys and Zack Snyder acolytes, you know, talk about how big the latest Marvel movie was compared to the DC movies. And they like chart box office like it's sports. Why would we want to know these numbers? Who cares? Just watch the movies and Netflix is buying them and putting them in front of you. And they're all equal.
The filmmakers deserve to know them. I think.
Well, the filmmakers, the filmmakers can, could know. And that's a problem. I'm saying that is a problem.
You don't think, for me, this is a pretty, the argument sort of begins and ends with how Netflix is their disruption. I mean, you're talking, I think you really clarified for it or crystallized my point when you're talking about how these are not distributors, these are tech guys, and they are corrupting art and how we experience it and what it fundamentally even is. And that bothers me. And I'm not saying that it's not inevitable, and I'm not.
But that doesn't have to do with the way that they're putting them out.
We can overcome it, but I'm just saying that it's fucked and it's happening and we're letting it happen, and I think it's dangerous.
Well, it's also changing. Not everything's the same all the time.
I mean, this is what I think bothered me the most about your article, and a lot of stuff that has been an argument I am with you, but when you said that movies are what shows on a big screen and that's the way that we can define cinema because everything else has been stretched, I think it's outdated and I don't think it's that helpful. Like, the fact that I might see I Don't Feel at Home in the World anymore on a small screen, it might not be exactly what the filmmaker intended, but I still saw it. Like, your assumption that everyone is watching it between bathroom breaks and scrolling on their iPhone. Like, I've definitely watched plenty of things in that shitty way, but there's lots of things that I really have
but
seen.
But the idea of that concept of it being, like, how do we define movies anymore is not meant... I mean, it may not have come across clearly, but the idea was that it is the opposite of outdated, that it's trying to reckon with movies were, you know, film was a literal thing for a long time, and it was very obvious and easy on a tangible level to say this is film and this is not, and now our technology has made the words that we use to describe certain experiences obsolete. And so now, you know, when you're saying, like, what is a movie... I don't know what separates a movie, as we call it, from a 90-minute or 70-minute or who knows how many minute piece of content that we find on Netflix. And so part of what I was suggesting was that, and this wasn't a value judgment, was just saying that the only thing that a movie really means anymore, to me at least, is something that we see in movie theaters. We need new words to describe.
But why draw the lines?
Yeah, I don't really care.
I'd rather enjoy something than define it. Yeah, wait. I need Dave's opinion. Whatever
me.
Dave believes, I will believe. Dave, final word.
Okay. The mistake is assuming that a business is ever going to choose to preserve a niche art in favor of profits.
I'm not assuming that they're going to. I'm accepting that they won't, and I'm mad about it.
Yes, no, that's good. You could yell at the monolith. I fully encourage that in all sorts of ways, but it makes complete sense what they're doing. And like before Netflix started doing these things, I was asking for somebody to come rescue like small indie films and things that you had to go to festivals to see.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of came along and did that for me. And now it's like I also moved somewhere away from all the art house theaters, and I have delayed release dates, and not for Netflix movies. I think the Discovery kind of worked. I was surprised how much something like the OA worked, where it was like, I think the not having ratings and stuff, it's bad for the creative side of it in terms of perpetuating like funding or feedback, but we've seen it work for the TV model, and I think it can work for the movie model because of what you're saying, David. Is like there's not much difference between a 70-minute piece of content and a, you know, quote-unquote movie. But, like, hopefully it sharpens storytelling and diversifies it, which at least it seems to be doing, as well as giving access to these purchases, which, you know, luckily get to premiere somewhere as a film, but then get dispersed.
Well, Dave, you mentioned the OA, which is made by people who had a big slashy debut at Sundance, whose movies made, you know, some small amount of money in theaters and made the jump to television like so many other artists because there was more money and there was more audience there.
And
now
you have Zal, the director of that movie, sitting on stage at a Netflix panel this past February, talking about how he doesn't want to make art house movies anymore. And by art house movies, he means movies that play at your local art house because he's frustrated that no one sees them. And now he really can't see himself making that kind of move again.
I
think it's interesting. You know, I'm not necessarily, it frustrates me a little bit, but
the only sense he's going to have, and I think it's different with the shows than it is with the movies, but
I think, as you said,
over social media. I mean, I was talking to a filmmaker whose movie is on Netflix now a little while ago, and they were like, I did not make this comparison in my article because I thought it was going to be insensitive, but in saying that it... not to me like a stillborn kid, but like looking in their eyes and thinking about how this movie they spent all this time on was just lost into the void, was very, I don't know, it was very hard even vicariously to experience.
I mean, it's interesting because the one movie that I actually like helped theatrically release ended up then getting like a tiny like three theater theatrical release just so they could say they did it, went to Netflix through a Film Buff deal, and now Netflix is producing their next movie. They shot it with like a Netflix production company. And it seems like, knowing those people, I want to see the stories they're going to tell, but I don't know if there would be any other way that it would go about it, having, you know, worked with them creatively and knowing their standards and their, you know, limitations at the time. So it seems like that avenue is wider than it was, you know, when we were going through film school or probing around, you know, different festivals. And it's hard for me to think of that as a bad thing. It's sort of like the argument of, you know, film versus digital projection. I understand the art of it and the feeling of it is different. But I think, like, most theatrical experiences these days are, like, giant blockbuster nothings because people have Netflix. So if we need to meet them at that level, I'd rather they have quality there. It
puts an emphasis on the film festival. I mean, going to your local film festivals or going to the nearest one or making the trek out to Sundance. You know, Netflix is now a partner in Sundance for good reason. It's where they're going to be buying films for the rest of their life.
So now your argument against my perceived elitism is pay thousands of dollars to fly to the mountains of Utah?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm actually not. No, I'm not saying. No, I'm not saying going to Sundance. I'm saying there are lots of film festivals all over the country, and that's an option for people, but they can also just watch it on Netflix. But people who are driven like you can go to film festivals.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to bring this all to a close, it's what we're seeing here is the increased films are becoming more of a niche than anything else. I think when you see how much the theater scene is thriving in New York City right now, that like
if this, you see it being you being us in New York,
right.
Most people not.
Right. Well, no, I'm saying. I mean, like, I think film is on its way to becoming like opera or something like that, where really you have it's very localized. But you know, like opera, you can listen to recordings of whatever shows that you happen to love anywhere you are, anywhere in the world. But in order to have a certain film experience, you're going to have to travel to a physical place. I mean, the more abstract the concept gets, the more localized it gets at the same time, and that's a phenomenon we've seen in other art forms, and I think it's only going to continue.
But it hasn't destroyed those art forms, has it?
It's the argument that James Gray made in an interview on Little Gold Men podcast you might have heard of, comparing film to opera as a kind of an art form that has existed and flourished and is likely going to become much more specialized and different.
Sounds interesting.
Man, we should have had an opera podcast is what I'm hearing.
I got. That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week. In the meantime, tell people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the executive entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with your friends, or you can leave comments, which we will check out. As I mentioned in our Netflix segment, people were giving me shit there, and I accept that. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find me stirring the pot at IndieWire and on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, DA7E. It's also my Twitter handle. This week on Star Wars Spoilers, like I mentioned, we're going to do the Fast and Furious franchise. And then also, there's only 5 weeks of off-season tour left before we begin our huge Rethrones build-up to Game of Thrones, which is going to be about the seasons. And then we're going to do 2 big spoiler episodes about all the production spoilers coming up. So, depending on your flavor, if you like Game of Thrones, put Storm of Spoilers, check it out wherever you're fine.
Dave, you guys still have like Joanna, who is like all seeing when it comes to Game of Thrones. Does she have
the Sauron of Game of Thrones?
I mean, does she, or do you, or do either of you have an inkling as to where the show is going, or are you pleasantly lost along with the rest of us now that they've gone past the books?
We are feeling pretty good about not, even though we don't have the books, knowing that we know the shape of this season.
Maybe you should listen to Storm of Spoilers to find out.
I do a whole podcast about Game of Thrones when I can just ask Dave.
Well, this week, it's about the Fast and Furious franchise.
Check your privilege,
which,
David.
I know you love.
Check your privilege. You live in the bubble where you, with Dave.
One day I'll know
you. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at MarietyFair.com with Joanna, where she's going to be writing about Game of Thrones for us, too. You can read instead of listen, but please listen to Storm of Spoilers. It's great. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where we continue to love hearing from you and answering this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of Unforgettable, which cinematic scorned ex do you feel bad for?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Never own, I don't conversate, I don't compromise. I just penetrate, sex, money, murder. These are the breaks, these are the times. Level number 9, look up in the sky. Tennis on the way, tennis on the way, tennis on the way. Motherfucker, I got winners on the way. You ain't shit without a buddy on your belt. You ain't shit without a ticket on your plate. You ain't sick enough to put it on yourself. You ain't rich enough to hit the light escape. Tell me when this stretch is gonna be my fate. Gonna be a fate, gonna be a fate. Peace to the world, let it rotate. Sex, money, murder, our DNA.